50 million people worldwide. More at lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's now time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, where listeners like you produce your own programs. This airtime is a free service for KPFT listener members, offered to those interested in sharing their knowledge and talent with other listeners. This is also a space to audition new programming. Opinions expressed on Open Journal may not reflect the views of the Pacifica Foundation, its staff, board, or volunteers. Information shared on Open Journal should not take the place of appropriate professional consultation. Now, it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, here on 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Welcome to Open Journal. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Dr. Peg Nosek, and with me is Dr. Christine Adams, a psychologist in private practice. We're both members of the Board of Healthcare for All Texas. We like to start each of our shows by debunking a myth, and the myth today is that Medicare is going broke. Yes, folks, that is not true. It's not true that Medicare is going broke so that we can't afford a universal single-payer health care plan, a health care system in the United States. Instead of privatizing Medicare and turning it over to for-profit insurers such as the Medicare Advantage programs, or increasing the age of Medicare enrollment, we need to expand Medicare to a Medicare for All National Health Insurance Program. That's our position in Healthcare for All Texas. Our guest today is Dr. Ed Weisbart. And he's the chair of the Missouri chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. He'll be talking to us today about how Medicare for All is a solution to our current healthcare crisis. Please call us with your questions or comments at 713-526-5738.
We often forget the history of Medicare because it is now a very, very popular program, but there was initial very bitter resistance to it. Before we had Medicare, the elderly were at very high risk of falling into poverty because most people had health insurance through their employer, and then when people retired, they had no health care. And they had difficulty paying for their medical care at a time where they were more sick. And you're probably unaware that Medicare also funds a vast majority of our residency programs in the United States. So it funds resident physician salaries and benefits, and it gives subsidies to teaching hospitals in exchange for training those residents. So Medicare is subsidizing our entire healthcare system, because it does fund medical training, and it does take care of the sickest among us, while the private insurance gets to reap the profits from cherry-picking from the healthiest among us. Our current system is financially unsustainable as it is, and only if we have an improved Medicare for All national health system will we have an affordable and sustainable and high-quality healthcare system. So we pose this question to our listeners, as we usually do, is what do you think a health insurance company does for us, for our healthcare system, that we can't do without them? Keep in mind that every other industrialized country has some form of national health insurance program, and they strictly limit the role that health insurance companies play in their healthcare systems. And the Commonwealth Fund just published their June study. They looked at 12 nations, and the United States came in last again among 12 industrialized nations in terms of our performance on healthcare. But we again came in number one in terms of the cost of our healthcare system.
Now, July is the month when we celebrate the anniversary of the signing of the act that created Medicare. This will be the 49th anniversary of the establishment of our Medicare system. And I think, all in all, everyone is very satisfied with the care that they get under the Medicare system. So we're very fortunate today to have with us Dr. Ed Weisbart. And Dr. Weisbart, we have you on the phone now, is that correct?
It is correct.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Could you start out with giving our listeners a very brief explanation of how our current system of private medical insurance, as opposed to our Medicare system, but the private medical insurance system, is dysfunctional, and why we need a Medicare for All national health system?
Sure. Well, first, let me just start by thanking you for doing such a terrific job at Open Journal and having shows like this. So it's really important to help us all get more educated. Thank you for this. What's wrong with our current system? Well, there's some good, but there's plenty that's messed up. We have, as you said, we have absurdly high costs for healthcare. We spend roughly double what any other industrialized nation spends on healthcare per person. And this means that the cost of our care is a barrier to people going for it. It means that when you do go for it, the cost of our health care is the number one driver of bankruptcies in the United States. Because of the high cost, that makes us more vulnerable to other problems like the housing crisis. But really, medical costs were the number one driver of the start of bankruptcy for most people who declared it. And, of course, the cost has a huge impact on society as a whole, diverting funds from what else the country could be doing.
Oh, I think we've lost Dr. Weisbart. We'll get you back here on with us in just a second. But in the meantime, we do have a caller. Let's talk with Steve. Steve?
Hi, I was going to ask, obviously, to that question about what can the insurance companies do that a single payer can't do, and I don't think the insurance companies can do jack, in my opinion. I think they're evil, satanic forces. Anyway, the question I was going to pose is if President Obama had a Lyndon Baines Johnson mentality back in early 2009 when he had the House, the Senate, and the huge support of the American people coming off the 2008 election, if he had a mentality, I'm going to shove single payer down, we're going to break this filibuster, and we're going to break some necks to do it, I wonder if we could have gotten it done. Because, you know, I'm inclined personally to think that had Lyndon Johnson been in Obama's shoes in 2009, we would have had a single payer Medicare for All enacted in law right now as we speak. And I just want to know, I just wanted to get your and I guess the doctor's opinion on that.
Okay. Well, I think we'd have to analyze the forces in opposition to that. We are looking at a very different climate, a political climate now compared to 1965 when Lyndon Baines Johnson was doing this. You're listening now to KPFT 90.1. I'm Dr. Peg Nosek with Dr. Christine Adams. This is Open Journal, and our guest speaker is Dr. Ed Weisbart, and we're talking about how a Medicare for All national health system is the solution to our health care crisis. And in response to Stephen's question about what if President Obama had tried to really take a forceful stance for a single payer in the Medicare for All model, would we have that system today? Do we have Dr. Weisbart back yet? Not yet. Okay. We're trying to regain our connection with him. Christine, what are your thoughts about that political climate question?
Obviously, single-payer supporters were very disappointed, and they were not really even invited to the table. And the insurance companies really wrote the Affordable Care Act, and they wrote it, you know, for their benefit. And, you know, I just think the political climate these days is very difficult to have any progressive issues go forward. And you know, the ACA as, you know, as inadequate as single-payer supporters think it is. It is a step in the right direction, and we're hoping to build on that, expand it, and move to a single-payer system.
My only point about the political climate is...
Oops. Are you there, Stephen? Oops. Oh, we've got Ed back. Okay. Ed, are you there? Are you with us?
I am. I'm so sorry. We had a storm problem here last night, and the power has been interrupted intermittently, so
we're used to
my cell phone. Hopefully it just is okay.
We're used to storms in Houston.
We can relate. Okay, well, while we were in the process of getting our connection back with you, we had a very interesting caller about who posed the question, you know, what if President Obama had taken the stance of Lyndon Johnson and really pushed hard for single-payer? Do you think that the political forces would have backed down, political forces in opposition to it would have backed down, and that we could indeed have had a single payer at this very moment?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. I didn't hear everything you said.
I'm sorry, I'll try again. If President Obama had taken a very strong stance in favor of single payer, could he have pushed it through against the opposition in the current political climate, just as Lyndon Baines Johnson had pushed Medicare through in his political climate? Would we have had, I mean, this is very conjectural, but could we have had a single-payer system now if we had really had someone pushing it? We didn't. In 2009, we didn't have anybody, you know, in the political arena with that kind of power pushing it through. But if President Obama had really pushed it through and advocated for it in the ramrod approach that Johnson had taken with Medicare, would we have a single-payer system right now?
I have no way of knowing the answer to that. I think in President Obama, we have a president who completely understands the issues around single-payer. When he was a senator in the state of Illinois, he was a vocal proponent of a single-payer model, and he personally made all of the arguments that we all make today for single-payer. So he gets the issue. I think his heart is generally in the right place on the issue, but he's also very pragmatic, and the forces against which he was up against were quite strong, and he put in a program that I think does help some people in many ways. It helps me have insurance. It does help. It does bring some good, but as we all know, it doesn't go nearly far enough. It fails to address the issues that I outlined at the beginning of the show. Could he have pushed harder? I don't know. I don't think we're going to get there from having the right president in place. I think we need to have the right president in place, and he would certainly serve in that role. But I think the issue is that you don't get major social change that's lasting and stable and sustainable by having one voice from the top driving it.
Right.
I think the issue is what you're doing on this radio show, getting everybody to sort of demand this and elect people and make the kind of cultural changes that we need to make it happen. It has to happen from the ground up, I believe.
Good. We have another caller. May, can we stop for just a second and take this call from Mary?
Hello.
Yes, Mary.
How are you, Peg?
Hi, doing great. Thank you. Go ahead with your question.
Well, first of all, I really think we need to get Citizens United straightened out. But beyond that, though, I think one of the things I'm realizing lately, one of the things that people aren't really realizing about single payer is that it would actually create many jobs. I think people are thinking it's going to destroy jobs, because they don't know what's going to happen to the people in the health insurance industry, but the net gain in jobs is going to be much greater than that. And since people are so worried about jobs, I think they really ought to know the facts about that.
You know, I think you're exactly right. We talk about being worried about the jobs in the health insurance industry. Most of the jobs there are actually not the world's best jobs. They tend to have roughly 50% turnover over the course of 2 years. So whether we do a single-payer program or not, the chances are that half of the people in that industry are not going to be working in that industry 2 years from now anyway, because that's the nature of having such high jobs. And the people that, you know, the people that are there are the very people we would need to re-galvanize the healthcare workforce. So,
yes,
you know, they
could be retrained for new jobs that are still in the medical field, but just slightly different jobs, more direct patient care rather than pushing papers.
I also think more importantly than that is the issue that healthcare, the cost of healthcare today is what's eroding the ability of businesses to prosper and grow in the United States, along with other things. So if you deburden the health, the rest of American industry with the onus of paying for healthcare in the way they do today, you'll find businesses more able to start employing here.
You're listening to Open Journal. We're talking about how a single payer health insurance system is the solution to our healthcare problems. This is Dr. Peg Nosek with Dr. Christine Adams. Our guest today is Dr. Ed Weisbart. We'll be right back.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston, Texas. The time is 9:45. Here's a look at traffic and weather. There are no accidents reported currently. There is slow traffic on the 610 West Loop southbound from Shepherd to I-10 Katy Freeway. The travel time there is almost 12 minutes. The current temperature is 83 degrees with scattered clouds. Humidity is 86%. Winds are out of the east at 2 miles per hour. There's a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Otherwise, today will be mostly sunny with a high of 99 and a low of 79 degrees. Please stay tuned after the community spotlight for Bird Note, followed by Wide Open Spaces at 10 o'clock, and then SOS Radio at 1 o'clock. And now back to community spotlight. Today's program is on healthcare reform.
We're talking today with Dr. Ed Weisbart, and our topic is Medicare for All National Health Program. Call us with your questions or comments at 713-526-5738. And we were in the middle there of before the break of a very lively conversation about the issue of jobs and health care, and we'd like to move on now with Dr. Weisbart about how Medicare for All system could control costs without lowering quality, and who would decide on what health benefits would be included. Dr. Weisbart, could you comment on those topics?
Sure. I think the strategy to do this is really critical and right within our grasp. All you need to do is align interests. build out, cap the economies of scale, and be careful about the governance. And we know how to do all of that. By aligning interests, I mean have a system that includes members of Congress. So if members of everybody in the country, including Congress and the president and the rest, are in the same system, you're going to have them personally vested in making sure that it stays strong. Second, you can control costs pretty easily. You can control costs through capping the economies of scale that would be inherent in this sort of a system. The very nature of insurance is to spread the cost of a high expense, very sick person across the full population. And if you have a small group, say you have 100 people from one employer like we do today, who are buying their own insurance as a small group, the cost there is going to be very high because they have to be protected against the risk of one very sick person in that group. The larger the group is, the more stable it is. And, of course, Medicare for All would be the way to do that. The other couple things to think about this are that insurance companies today, and we have hundreds of them, all repeat the same work. So they all have dozens, hundreds, in some cases thousands of people who are operating their information systems programs, who are doing their sales programs, who are doing all of their underwriting and all of these kinds of functions. Some of those functions, first of all, wouldn't have to happen at all. And others of them, one place could do them rather than literally hundreds of places having the same people repeating the same work over and over again. That's just a huge burden in expense that you can imagine has other implications. But then lastly, of course, the economy of scale means you can leverage purchasing power of a large group. So you know, Medicare Part D has been prevented by Congress from negotiating the prices of drugs. But the Veteran Administration in the United States is a better model for that because they are not prevented, and they actually can buy drugs at perhaps the lowest rates in the country. And as a result, the pharmacy expense there is cheaper than it is in most other places. So if you enable the purchasing power, you can start to take a real advantage of this and lower the cost. None of this undermines quality. And indeed, we would the proposal for a Medicare for All program actually spells out an independent national board of, they call it the National Board of Universal Quality and Access, I believe. This would be 15 people who would not have any financial conflicts of interest. They would be appointed by the president, and in most of these appointments, as in this one, it would be with the advice and consent of the Senate. And it would include healthcare professionals, citizen patient advocates, representatives of institutional providers, health advocacy groups, and labor unions. And this group, on a biannual, on a twice-a-year basis, would establish the universal best quality standard of care in all the things that we're concerned about, access, quality, efficiency, budgets, staffing ratios and things, so that we would have an independent national system that guarantees good quality of care at an appropriate cost for all of us.
Those are excellent comments. Thank you so much, Dr. Weisbart, for summarizing that for us. You're listening to KPFT. It's 9:51, and I'm Dr. Margaret Nosek, or Peg Nosek, and our guest today is Dr. Ed Weisbart. We're talking about expanding Medicare to everyone. We have a caller, John. Could you please tell us your question or comment?
Well, yeah, I got a couple either way, I guess. I am not a fan of the ACA. I do think it's a huge government overreach. But, for example, where are the savings that we, the payers, are supposed to be seeing? I was told, I believe, by Obama we'd be saving $2,500 per family, and I'm paying $120 more a month for the same coverage now. And on top of that, I really would like someone to respond to, why would we want the government in a single-payer system? They can't even run the Veterans Administration without killing people and not taking proper care. So why is it that the American taxpayer should have any faith in the government to run a program when they can't even run something for the veterans? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
John, Dr.
Weisbart? Thank you. Some great comments, and they're good questions to be thinking about. If I could start with the VA piece and then come back to the overall savings argument. The VA, I think, is a great example of how you can take one group of people in the United States, in this case veterans, but you could pick any of another small groups, carve them off so that they're not in the mainstream of healthcare, have them have their own system, and then Congress, when it's looking for money, can start cutting and marginalizing and not really giving the support that the VA needs. The VA, despite all of these things we've been hearing lately in the news, has some of the best health outcomes on many measures in the country. So it's not a completely bad system. It's actually got many strong positive features, but I think we've seen them not having the funding that they are supposed to really, really have. If they were part of a mainstream group that the entire country was in, it would be completely different. You're getting to the issue of trust of the government, and the government actually does some things very poorly, but it does some things really well. And this kind of a program is the kind of a program that if it's properly funded, which of course I think it should be, since we would all be in it, would be one of the things that they excel at. Like you, I'm not here to really defend or attack the Affordable Care Act. But I think what you're seeing when, there's two things about the cost issue that you brought up. The first is that there's not a lot in the Affordable Care Act that really should be expected to control the costs of health care. I think we saw this in Massachusetts when they did something very similar, and I think we need to do more on that basis. But the other thing to think about is that when you get more people in a large group, before you do that, the younger, healthier people, if they're carved out as their own group, they can pay a smaller premium because they're generally low risk and healthy. If you have 60-year-olds in their own group, their premiums are going to be relatively high because you can predict that they're going to be sicker. If you put them all into the same group, and if you say that you can't charge more, much more, for being older than being younger, all of a sudden what happens, of course, is that the incredibly high premiums that 60-year-olds were paying become smaller, and the incredibly low premiums that 23-year-olds were paying would become higher as we get more towards everybody paying a fair share rather than not. If you think about it, it's something that we're all hoping to become 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years old. It begins to make more sense.
Okay, thank you. Let's take another call from Brandon.
Hi. What I need to ask, I'm not too familiar with the Affordable Health Care Act or Medicare. My concern and what I assume is that I would have to get into a certain type of medicine. I choose holistic medicine for my lifestyle. So my question is holistic medicine considered as an option for people, or do I have to conform to a certain way of medicine? And is that are people that do choose holistic medicine, are they considered, for a cheaper way, or because it does seem to be healthier, in my opinion? You know, I don't know if that's a factor, but I would like to know what holistic medicine is.
Under today's system, you have very little ability to advocate for insurance companies to cover things that they're not choosing to cover, like holistic medications. They're corporate. They're investor owned. They really are not. They don't have no business reason to be directly responsive to the requests and demands like you're making of an insurer. On the other hand, if you have a system that's owned and managed by people whom we elect, the dynamic starts to change, and there suddenly is the ability to have an influence on it. I mentioned this governing board that has many normal citizens on it, and we have influence over these kinds of decisions. So you only want a system to pay for things that are proven to be worth paying for, but the mechanism for getting there is easier, I would expect, under a single payer system than it would be under the current model.
I'd like to thank you so very much, Dr. Weiss-Barton, for answering our questions today. Thank you to all of the callers. This has been a wonderful, lively discussion. Please join us tomorrow. We're having our monthly meeting of our Healthcare for All Texas Houston chapter. It's going to be at the United Methodist Church, St. Paul's United Methodist Church, 5501 Main Street, and in the Jones Building, or email us if you like at info@hcfat.org. Thank you for joining us today. We'll talk to you next month.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. Visit kpft.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website at kpft.org. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. To get in touch with the program director, send an email to pd@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 308. Your feedback via social media is also welcome. We're at KPFT on Twitter and KPFT Houston on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Wide Open Spaces up next. You can view our complete program schedule at kpft.org. And thank you for tuning in to today's Open Journal here on Pacifica Radio, 90.1 in Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
This is Bird Note. Seabirds gather where food is abundant, at the edge of North America's continental shelf, where nutrient-rich waters nurture a wealth of squid and small fish. Let's go take a look. It's a summer day off the coast of North Carolina. We set sail east over 75 feet of water, but it's not long before the seafloor drops off more than 12,000 feet, and things change. Seabird researcher Tom Johnson explains.
Right at the greatest amount of slope of that seafloor, there's an area of upwelling and productivity. And in that area, in a very small area, you can have very large flocks of shearwaters and storm petrels, boreal migrants like jaegers meeting perhaps south polar skuas coming up from the Antarctic, seabirds that are coming from all corners of the Atlantic Ocean.
What's it like to experience this remarkable convergence?
To have the opportunity to wake up in the morning and be offshore in blue water that's thousands of feet deep,